Did you know thousands of European buildings use one-tenth the energy demanded in North America? It's called Passive House. I'm Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. On May 24, 2008, I recorded a workshop by one of the leading experts on the design of super energy-efficient buildings. Dr. Guido Wimmers describes houses, municipal buildings, row houses, and even office buildings that are shockingly energy-efficient. In these times of peak oil and high energy prices, not to mention global warming, Americans and Canadians need to learn fast from this new technology used in European buildings. Canada has developed a standard for greener buildings called LEED, which stands for Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. Some experimental American homes are called net zero. But the Europeans have already surpassed us. They are producing, mass-producing buildings, which use far less energy. As Guido Wimmers explains in a brochure from Equilibrium, his new Vancouver consulting company, quote, "Unlike LEED, the Passive House standard primarily focuses on reducing the long-term energy consumption of the building by reducing the heating and cooling demand to a near-zero level," end quote. These buildings use an inner air barrier, an outer windshield, an air exchange system, and very careful construction techniques at every window, corner, and connection. As Guido Wimmers points out in the following speech, a very low demand for heating or cooling opens the door to alternative technologies powered by wind, solar, or geothermal. For example, these buildings can be so efficient it is possible to heat an average 1,500-square-foot home in a light winter condition with less than 24 candles. The new standard is in metric, so you might have to do some conversions. One key number is the amount of kilowatt-hours per square meter per year required to heat the building. That's kilowatt-hours per square meter per year required to heat the building. While an average Canadian home might require 150 kilowatt-hours per square meter for heating, the Passive House will use just 15 kilowatt-hours, one-tenth the money going to the oil, natural gas, or utility company. Not only will this save tons of money in a highly stressed economy, but the rooms are more comfortable for humans. The temperature remains stable, the air is cleaner, and noise is greatly reduced. A Passive House building also cuts carbon emissions by at least 90%, a huge bonus to reduce greenhouse gases. For you Googlers, Wimmers is spelled W-I-M-M-E-R-S, and Passive House is P-A-S-S-I-V-H-A-U-S. This speech has been edited to fit the one-hour radio format. You can download the whole speech from the Climate Solutions page at ecoshock.org. The Q&A for the workshop is also available there, all as free downloads. Meanwhile, let's hear from Dr. Guido Wimmers.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation. I would like to welcome everybody of you, and it's a really nice sunny day outside, so I really appreciate that just quite a few have found a way here to the Lighthouse Sustainable Center. Just a very few words about me. I'm a German. I grew up in Germany. The last 12 years I've lived in Austria. I'm an architect by training. I did my PhD in buildings, so I'm something a little bit in between, an architect, so the artist, and on the other side, more like an engineer, so I understand both languages. I began to concentrate on energy efficiency during I was studying, so that's 15 years ago or something like that. Today I want to introduce the Passive House, and first of all these issues and arguments in the surrounding fields. So, for example, economy, ecology, comfort, healthy living, and all that stuff. I want to introduce and explain the idea, how a Passive House works, and show you for sure a couple of examples. And then I will take a little bit of sidestep to future constructions, wood constructions, that what is pretty new right now in Europe. So we will see if that will happen in Canada too. I don't know. Let's start. You can see that, I think most of you know that graph. That's the oil price, so dollar per barrel over the last 40 years or something like that. So you see a long stable period, and then the first two steps here, that was oil price crisis one and oil price crisis two. From there on, we see a zigzag like that one. So that was caused by wars, by hurricanes, by I don't know what. So different kind of issues have caused this zigzag. But what we see right now is something completely different. From 2002 up to 2005, so in between 5 years, the oil price has increased more than five times. And I had to extend that graph with the last part. So right now we are at $135 per barrel. So that's close to seven times higher than it was about 6 years ago. And we have had a lot of arguments about what brings that or what increased that oil price and what happens there. I think at the end it's very simple, because you can see all these tiny zigzag course, these are wars and so on. What we see right now, it's very simple. It's a question of demand and supply. At the end of 2007, we have had about 6.6 billion people on that planet. Nearly the half of that people are living at the cusp of a moderate prosperity, so they want to use energy. They want to have a car. They want to have a TV or whatever. So that's about 3 billion people are on their way to reach something what we would call the middle class. Most of them are living in the Asian region, so as you can see here, population in India and China, that is for sure the big mass. But don't forget about Eastern Europe. Eastern Europe is about 500 million people, and that's pretty much the same. So all these people want to use more energy in future. And that's very simple, the reason why, because the oil price is rising. When we take a look to the fossil energy consume of the humans over a longer time period, so let's take a look a few thousand years back and a few thousand years into the future, you can just have a picture like that one. So everything before 1800 something was pretty much solar energy. It was wind, it was water, it was biomass, but all caused by solar power. So that was very sustainable. Then in this time, it starts with coal and a little bit later with oil. So that was the beginning of the fossil age. And right now, I guess it's a really moot point to discuss if we already have reached peak oil, if that happens 1-2 years ago, or if that will be had or in 5 or 10 years. That's really a moot point to discuss. I think what we really have to see is that we are at the top of the curve. So when you take a larger look like that one, you see that is a really short period. And a smart Arabian guy about 30 years ago, he has explained that the Stone Age doesn't end because the people haven't had any stones anymore. So it's the same with the fossil age. The fossil age will not end because we don't have fossil energy anymore. It is because we will find smarter solutions. That is the main reason why something like that will end. And I think right now we are living in a period where exactly that will happen. So a colleague of mine has called that period the fossil fart, because in human history it's really just a very short thing. Let's take a little bit of a closer look to Canada's situation right now. So all these data are from the Energy Use Data Handbook 06. I haven't taken a look to 07, but I'm quite sure that the figures haven't changed very much. So you can see the energy what Canada is using to heat their space. 55% is natural gas. So I'm living here since 8 months, and I was really a little bit wondering about the word natural gas. Has ever anybody of you asked what that means? I mean, that's a very nice suggestion. It's like organic or something like that. So it's still fossil. Okay, it's maybe the best one of the fossils, but it is still fossil, so it's not really green and unsustainable. Nobody's talking about natural oil, natural uranium. That's natural too. Okay, however, so 55% gas. 11% oil, so together 66%. But then we have a little bit more, because in the 19% of electricity are close to 10% fossil energy too. So we end up with at least 2/3 fossil energy, but very likely up to 3/4. The energy use altogether is about 220,000 million kilowatt hours. The total floor space is about 1,500 million square meter. So when you divide these two numbers, you end up with about 150 kilowatt hours per square meter. That is the energy what an average Canadian household officially use for heating. But we have to assume that not really every square meter is heated. And everybody of you knows that. So nobody is really heating the room where you're sleeping up to 22 degrees. Most of the people don't do that. So a lot of the rooms are just tempered and not heated. So when we try to reduce that on the real, on the really heated space, we end up with a number which is way higher than 150, which is very likely over 200, somewhere around 220. That's the really honest energy use for a heated square meter in the average Canadian household. New buildings, for sure, they are better. So there are somewhere around 100, just for heating, just the red part. It doesn't matter if that's lead silver or whatever, or lead gold. The next category is what we call in Europe is low energy housing. You will find different definitions. In some countries it's 50, in some countries it's 40 kilowatt hours for the heating energy. So that's a kind of a political decision how to name that chart. Okay, we call it low energy house, that's about 50, something like that. So that's a way under that what we would hear, or what, for example, a lead platinum house would need. And that what I want to talk about today is the so-called passive house. That is limited with 15 kilowatt hours. So we remember when we take, or let's assume it's 150, and we know it is in reality a little bit more. And the passive house, what we want to talk about is 15, so it's 1/10. The idea or the first approach into that direction is not really new. I found one of the really first ones was here in Canada. It was the Saskatchewan house in Regina. That was 1978. That was one of the really first high-efficient houses. It was not a passive house, but it was quite good. But since then, a lot of different things happened, a lot of different influences. For example, oil was really, really cheap. So people haven't cared about that anymore. In the late 80s, beginning of the 90s, the people in Europe were forced to go more into that direction, because one thing was for sure the energy price. Europe has no own energy, just a little bit in the North Sea, but there's also a little bit of coal, but it's not sufficient to supply completely Europe, so they have to import energy. That forced them about 30 years ago to think more about that. So the first passive house was built in 1992, that's now 15 years ago, in Germany, together with some scientists from Sweden and from Austria. And since then, it was really a growing market. So right now, at the end of 2007, there are about 10,000 passive houses built in Europe. You will find about 7,000 in Germany and 2,500 in Austria. but you have to put it into a little bit better ratio, because Germany with 80 million people, Austria, little tiny Austria with 8 million people, so it's 1 to 10. A little bit similar like Canada to USA, 1 to 10. So you find by far the highest density in Austria. But especially this year is supposed to be very, very successful for a passive housing approach. We expect about 20,000 at the end of 2008. Because a lot of other countries like France, like Spain, Italy, and all these countries have adapted that kind of approach to their own building culture. And now it's really fast growing in Europe. So what is a passive house? Well, first of all, it's very simple. What you need is a very good insulation. That is one of the key issues. Because very simply, every kilowatt hour you don't lose, you don't have to put into again. Just that one here, that's a thermographic picture of a classic coffee machine and a thermos flask. Everybody knows what happens. If you fill in the hot coffee here in that thermos flask and wait about an hour or two, you can measure the temperature of that one, it's nearly equal. It's pretty much the same. But the one system has used a lot of energy to keep it warm, and the other one has used nothing. So that is the first really big thing, to use a lot of insulation. Then the second one is to orientate the buildings a little bit smarter, a little bit better, so use solar power. And you use that solar power passive because it's just about the windows. The windows let a lot of solar power into your room, into your house, and heat it up. So that's why the people call it the passive house, because you try to do a lot of things in that house passive without high tech or whatever. And if you reach that low amount of energy, the 15 kilowatt hours, it really makes sense to start thinking about internal heat profits like lighting, appliances, and the people who are living inside there. So, for example, everybody of you has a heating power about 70, 80 watts. So everybody of you is a little furnace. That's up to nothing in a conventional house with the use of 150 kilowatt hours per square meter or more. But when you reach that low amount, it really makes sense to think about that. Also, lighting appliances, they have quite a big influence. And for sure, heat recovery in the ventilation system is a precondition. Natural ventilation, what I've heard here, is very, very popular. And natural ventilation is nice in autumn and spring. But it will for sure not really work in winter, because there you would lose so much energy, more than the 15 kilowatt hours. So just with opening the window, you would lose more than 15 kilowatt hours. So you would never achieve the criteria of a passive house just with natural ventilation. And for sure, in summer, it's vice versa, because you want maybe to avoid all the hot air coming into your room. So a ventilation system with heat recovery also in summertime is a big advantage. So as I told you, I'm now about 8 months here, and I found a couple of similar approaches or going into the same direction. One of those is the Equilibrium House, former Net Zero Energy Healthy Housing. I guess they have changed that title because it's really a thumb breaker. And the second one, what I've seen, is the Net Zero House, which, I've seen a lot of discussions. Is net zero possible? And is that possible here in Canada? Because it's pretty cold. So, yeah, for sure it's possible. It's going to the same direction like a passive house, because a passive house is not net zero, so it still needs some energy, but a very, very small amount. The 15 kilowatt hours. And there are some other requirements, for example, the specific heat load, 10 watt per square meter. So that describes the maximum power your heating system have to put into the room when you have really the worst conditions. So minus 15 centigrade at the outside, you will never reach that here in Vancouver, but in Kelowna and Penticton, or in these regions. And 4 o'clock in the morning, so no solar heat gain, nobody at home, all lights are out, but still you have to heat that house. So that is the peak load, the 10 watt per square meter. So
can you actually get what the 10 watts per meter square?
That's the maximum heat load you have to put into. So at really the worst conditions, really cold, nighttime, no solar gain, nobody at home, so then you have to put in at the maximum 10 watt per square meter to heat the whole house. Just to give you an example, a candle has about 40 watt, or one candle would be good at the maximum for 4 square meter. So for 120 square meter house, which is a good size for a single family house, 30 candles would be sufficient for the absolute maximum. So that's really the worst case scenario, the coldest hour you will ever reach during the year, with minus 15 at the outside. So here in Vancouver, maybe 15 candles would be sufficient. I know nobody will try to heat his house with candles. It's just an example to make clear what we're talking about. You can assume about 3 watts for all the electrician stuff, so lighting, appliances, and all that stuff. So let's assume 150 square meter for the Imperial guys, 1,500 square foot. So that is a good size for a single family house. Let's assume about 3 watts you already have with your electrical system inside. So 450 watt you already have. And then you have a few people inside, so the passive system already will create about the half of the energy load, because the energy load, 10 watt, multiplicated by 150 square meters, 1,500 watt you really would use at, or need at the maximum. So you can easily achieve half of that just with the people inside and all the stuff you already have inside. So you see about 50% is really passive. You just have to put into another 50%. And that little amount of energy you have to put into is usually provided by a small heat pump, but it can be provided by a whole bunch of other different systems. So it don't has to be a heat pump. So that's just a little bit. Can you read that? Probably not. Okay, it's just TV is telling colder at the weekend, and the other guy is asking, shall we ask some friends around to keep the room temperature up? So invite 10 people, and you have 800 watts in your house for heating. So that's normally sufficient. So as I told you, there are a couple of similarities and intersections. So for example, net zero energy plus houses, well, people are discussing right now, that's pretty much nothing different than a passive house combined with a system for energy generation. So to make it very simple, build a passive house and putting 10, 15 square meter of photovoltaics on the roof and you have a net zero energy house. The key is just, first of all, to reduce the amount of energy that house will need. That's the key for the whole thing. Because if you're able to reduce that energy in average down to 10%, it's relatively easy to provide that small amount of energy with your own system, like, for example, PV, could be wind, could be whatever. And another thing, just to put it into dimensions, LEED, everybody of you probably knows about, so LEED stands for Leadership in Environmental and Energy Design. Very interesting, it's energy design, it's not energy efficient design. It's written in the book, you can read that from Green Building Council. They have quoted a research which says, okay, 85% of the environmental impact over the lifetime of a building is caused by energy. And that's true, there are a lot of different researches done, so they all end up with 85 up to 90%. That is the impact over the lifetime of a building on the environment. But in the LEED system, you just get 24%. And I guess LEED is really, really a good system, so I don't want to blame it, absolutely not. It was very necessary for North America to go the first steps into that direction. That is really, really good. But just in terms of energy, it's not focusing, from my point of view, from my personal point of view, it's not focusing enough. Okay, so the passive house is a little bit, or has a different approach, so you cannot really combine that with LEED Platinum or whatever. It's really different. Okay, so what do we have to do? First of all, as I told you, excellent insulation. That is the first really key issue. So every component has to be very good insulated. Every component means for sure also the windows and the doors. Because if you insulate your house just a little bit, let's talk about 10 centimeter or how many inches is that? About 4 inch insulation, something like that. Okay, you already have some insulation, but over 50% of the energy will float out through the windows. As long as you use just bat frames and two-pane glass. So to achieve passive house, three-pane windows are preconditioned. And it's not just about putting three-pane glass into a common frame, because that makes no sense. A three-pane glass is way better than an ordinary frame. So what you need is really good frame too. So the U well or R values we are talking about is for wall and roof somewhere between 10 and 6, just very roughly. So that's what we are looking for. In U values, that would be 0.1 up to 0.15. For the windows, these windows have to be under 0.85. The whole window, not just the glass, the complete window. So Vancouver will have a new green building code in autumn. And there will be a new regulation for windows. So windows have to be under 2.0. I was invited by the Window and Door Manufacturer Association. And they were discussing, is it possible to build a wood window with a new value of under 2? And so the simple answer from my side was pretty clear. Yes, for sure, it is possible. Because in Europe, you will find about 55 companies who are able to produce something like that under 0.85. So it is absolutely possible. Right now, what I've seen, there is no domestic company will sell such efficient windows, but there are already two or three. The third one is on the way.
Is that in Europe or?
No, here in Canada. Okay. So in Europe, you will find 55 companies
domestic.
Who are producing that stuff.
Yeah.
Here in Canada, right now, there is no domestic company, but two or three European companies who are importing that stuff. So you can find them. So, okay, windows are a very, very important part because there you lose, in average, about 50% of the energy. But then it's a little bit more, so you have to planify the whole envelope, which means you have to calculate and simulate several details. So how to bring a roof with a wall together, or how to install the windows into the wall assembly. So you really have to figure out what is the best way is, what the best way would be. And therefore, a couple of different tools how to calculate that. And usually architects, they do that 2-3 times, then they know their details. So it's not that architects have to calculate everything new with every project. And for sure, you have to calculate and simulate the whole building. And then there are some other unique requirements. So first of all, the so-called heat bridges. You can calculate and simulate these heat bridges. There's a value for that, the so-called phi value, and that one has to be under zero. So heat bridges, you have to avoid them. Next one is a continuous air tightness layer. So blower door test, I guess most of the people have heard about that. That one has to be under 0.6 at 50 Pascal. And then for sure, vapor diffusion is an issue. Let's take a little bit of closer look to heat bridges. What is a heat bridge? So everybody knows what that is. That is an old-fashioned motorcycle motor cooled by air. So a little bit closer look, you see all that cooling ribs here. You want to cool down the motor, you do that with cooling ribs because they have a high heat conductivity and transport the heat from the inside to the outside. So that is maximizing heat bridges. Well, let's take a look to Vancouver architecture. And yeah, there are some similarities. So I really, please don't misquote me, and I really don't want to blame any architect, but just in terms of building physics, really just in terms of building physics, because some people got angry about me. The Vancouver high-rise architecture is pretty much the same. Because you always will find these concrete slabs going out through the envelope, so penetrating the envelope. Concrete is a really good material for heat conductivity. So what will happen? These ribs here will heat up the building in summer and cool down the building in winter time. So exactly the opposite what you want to have. And if you combine that with steel or even worse, aluminum frames and bad windows, you have really a bad situation. Because you're putting pretty much the high conductivity materials in your envelope. So exactly that what you not should do.
You are listening to an Austrian expert on super energy efficient buildings called the Passive Haus design. Dr. Guido Wimmers has presented over 80 lectures at national and international conventions concerning the issue of low energy and passive housing. He is currently located in Vancouver, Canada, with the company Equilibrium Consulting.
This is EcoShock Radio. All environment, all the time. Get more info on the web at ecoshock.org.
You can go a little bit further. So, as I told you, for example, where to install the windows, how to install them, how to overlap them with the insulation layer, or whatever. So these are things you can really calculate, figure out what would be the best situation for a window in a wall assembly. And as I told you, you have to do that 1, 2, 3, 4 times, and then you have that details as an architect, and you don't have to redo it every time again. And these tools, a lot of them are freeware. For example, University of Berkeley has a very nice program to calculate these issues, and they are free. So it's not that you have to spend a lot of money to do that. It's just the time. And one very important issue, I know Vancouver is beaten by the leaky condo crisis, so that's about air tightness and vapor tightness. And please don't tumble that up. Air tightness is not the same thing with air tightness is not the same as vapor tightness. So these are two completely different issues. Air tightness, we're talking about two different kinds of air tightness. One thing is airtight from the inside, so you want to prevent or avoid that warm, humid air is going through your construction to the outside. Because if that happens, first of all, you will lose energy because that warm air is going to the outside. But that is something about energy efficiency. But the worst thing about that is that you're transporting humid air. So you're transporting vapor, water. And if that vapor is going through the construction and is cooling down on the way through the construction, it will reach a dew point and it will change from gas to liquid. So, and that is really a problem because then you have liquid water. As long as water is vapor, it's not a big thing. But when it became liquid, then it's a problem. And then in Europe, we are talking about a second layer, the so-called wind tightness. So the air tightness was on the inside, the wind tightness is on the outside. And that one you need to prevent cool air in winter or warm air in summer from infiltrating your insulation layers. For example, if you have bad insulation, mineral wool or cellulose fiber, whatever, so these loose kind of insulations, you have to avoid that the air is infiltrating that, because that would change the efficiency of that insulation layer. That is what we call wind tightness. But that's really just an issue about energy efficiency. So the insulation layer will not be so efficient anymore, so you're using more energy. But the other one, the air tightness on the inside, that is really about damage. So that's way more important. And it's not really the plain surface is not the problem. All the joints and the connections, these are the problems. To create something in a plain surface, that's really not tricky. But the joints and all the connections, these are the critical things. When the people are talking about breathable buildings, it doesn't mean that air should go in and out. So it's more about humidity should have the possibility to go in and out. And therefore you need something which is vapor diffusion open. Again, as long as you make sure that during the way from the inside to the outside, the humidity or the humid air will never reach a dew point, then it's okay. Then it is allowed that vapor would penetrate your wall or roof assembly. So at the end, the passive house is a little bit more than just the addition of the individual parts. It's you need an integral planning process. To achieve that high kind of quality, you have to team up with all different companies and professionals who are acting at a building site. For example, an electrician is usually the deadly enemy of an airtight envelope, because they are just drilling somewhere and haven't learned what they are doing there. They are just interested about I'm talking just, you know, I mean, there are some guys who really know what they do, but that is something which is very common, that plumbers or electricians hurt your surface, your layers, your airtight layer, your windtight layer, or vapor break or whatever. So that is an issue. You have to team up with them. You have to explain them. And you have to find with them together the best solution to make something airtight, to make something without heat bridges and so on. But the important thing you have to understand, that means that a lot of energy is transported from the inside through the envelope to the outside. Because of that, the outside gets warmer. What happens is, because of that high heat conductivity, the inside surface is relatively cold. In that case scenario, you stop that transport or you slow it extremely down. So not so much energy gets lost. That means that the inside surface of that building is way warmer. And that has a big influence on our comfort. That, for example, is a graph from a US American guy about 73 or something like that. So we are absolutely not talking about new things. Air temperature, what you try to achieve is something between 20 and 22 degrees. So we have to take a look in this part here. That is the surface or surrounding surface area temperature. So the surfaces, you can see, to reach a comfortable zone, you have to have a surface temperature at least about 18 degrees. You should have that one. So then the human beings are feeling really comfortable. If you have an uninsulated building, you end up with, well, 14 centigrade or colder. So it's just barely comfortable or even not comfortable anymore. These are a couple of measurements in a typical unrenovated house in Austria, and I've done some measurements here in my apartment now in Vancouver too. So they were pretty much the same, just the windows were not the same. So what you can see here, let's assume we have 0 degree at the outside and 20 centigrade at the inside. So that is a winter day, a cold winter day here in Vancouver, a mild winter day maybe in Kelowna. You will have surface temperatures about 18 degrees in average. So everywhere where you don't have heat bridges and other issues. Where you have these heat bridges, like in that corner, or here, that frame is going significant down. So about 13, 14 centigrade, you will reach there. And behind a sofa or a bookshelf or whatever, it could be way colder. Why? Yeah, it's pretty simple, because you have an insulation layer at the inside. The sofa is nothing else than an insulation layer on the inside. So you cool down the surface of the wall. That could be very critical, because in an average humidity inside air, you will reach a dew point at about 14 centigrade. So everything under 14 centigrade will cause condensation. And that could be a really big problem. Well, the result of this high energy housing is pretty much you have no thermal comfort, because it's really unsymmetrical. And as I told you, humans, and everybody of you knows that, we are very, very sensitive for unsymmetrical surrounding surface temperatures. But if you reach these low temperatures, you will reach the dew point, which means you have condensate, you have liquid water. And everybody knows what happens if you have liquid water on that planet, life grows. So in that case, it's mold. It don't has to be visible. It could be hidden in the construction too, which is sometimes even worse. And then for sure you have an unhygienic interior climate. It could be toxic. And a lot of illnesses like allergies or asthma or whatever are caused by mold. So you don't have just a sick building, you have sick people inside. What we're trying to achieve in, let's say, lowest energy housing or passive housing, we try to achieve that all surfaces are equally or nearly equally warm. So therefore, you have to reduce the heat bridges, you have to reduce the airflow, so increase the air tightness. And you see that all the surface temperatures are pretty much the same. Even the window, in that case, it is window pretty much like that one you see there in that sample is way better, and even the frame is still the weakest part, but it's way better than it was before. So there the result is really comfortable. You're feeling really comfortable even if it's zero or colder at the outside and healthy. The operation mode is, just to make it very simple, first of all, what you need is a continuous layer of insulation. No heat bridges, really continuous. Second of all, you need that air tightness and wind tightness going all around. You need the right orientation. You need good glazing. So right orientation means, if possible, to the south, because the south side is very easy to handle. In summertime, the sun is in a deep angle or in a high angle. So a little bit overhang or whatever can prevent can avoid overheating. And in winter time, it comes in a very flat angle, so you can use a lot of solar power. On the east and west side, that doesn't work anymore. Everybody knows, especially west side, huge windows at the west side in summertime usually bring an overheating situation, because overhang is not successful anymore. And then you need that, you need a little bit, it's not really high tech, it's just a little bit technique inside, it's a mechanical ventilation with a simple heat recovery unit, which avoids that you lose all your energy out of the window when you open it. If you achieve that, if you really reach 15 kilowatt hours, or let's say double of that, 30 kilowatt hours, then you're reaching a new kind of quality of the building. Which means that new technologies, like for example heat pumps or solar thermal power, that they can work really efficient. As long as you have an average building, the COP of a heat pump, maybe 2, maybe 3, but it's not possible to get higher because the temperature they have to produce is way too high. I mean, a heat pump is in a refrigerator since 70 years or something like that, or 60 years at least. So it's not really new technology, but to heat a house, it's relatively new technologies. They will have a chance. And also other energy systems, all the renewables, they will have a chance for supply. Like this one here is biomass, so pellets, it's just sawdust pressed together. Or photovoltaics, or wind power. So all the kind of new renewable energies, they will have a chance to supply, because we are talking about a tenth of the energy what we need. So then it makes sense. First of all, you have to invest every dollar in reducing the amount of energy you need. And if you reach a level, at that level, then it makes sense to invest a little bit more money into the energy supplying system, but not before you have reached at least 30 kilowatt hours per square meter. All right, so now I want to show you a couple of examples of architecture, especially from the Alpine region. So that's the part where I've lived the last 12 years. So that is something where, especially Tyrol, for example, is well known for, you know, that old, really old-fashioned style wood architecture. Well, we also have some not so old-fashioned new things. That one is a semi-detached house, so duplex house, designed in 1999 and built 2000. So each part of that is 160 square meter. So again, for the Imperial guys, 1,700 square foot, something like that. And what we have done is heat recovery ventilation, 90% efficiency. The heating is a small pellets, biomass furnace, a very small unit, and that's sufficient for both parts, so for both houses. And quite a bit solar thermal energy, so about 20 square meter per unit. And we end up with about an average over the last 7 years, 250 euro per year. That is the cost for heating and warm water, everything together, 250 euros. You have to know that the prices for energy in Europe are about three times higher, especially for electricity, is about three times higher than here. So if you would take that house and build it here in the mild Vancouver climate, I guess you would end up with about 100, maybe 150 bucks per year. So it really makes also economically sense. And I know that these figures very well, because that's my own house. What we've done at that time, I haven't had enough money to build a passive house. So it's not a passive house, it's very close to, but it's not. The reason for that is very simple. At that time, three-pane windows were too expensive. So if I would switch these windows into three-pane windows, I would reach a passive house standard. We have chosen three different layers. You see that here in the wall construction. So three different layers of insulation. And every of these layers has really a good reason to be there. First of all, yeah, at the inside you have that gypsum board, and then 4 centimeter of mineral wool. That's an issue for fire safety. The next one, the big part, is 18 centimeter cellulose fiber. Cellulose fiber, the reason for that was very simple. 18 centimeter, that is the biggest part of the insulation. So we have chosen a renewable, recyclable material. So something which is really green. And then at the outside, wood fiber boards are getting more and more common, and you can see that on that sample that's also filled with wood fiber. So that's a kind of insulation which is also completely green. It's really a nice material and quite good insulation values. Continuous layer at the outside to insulate at least a little bit the studs too, because in a construction like that, studs became the heat bridges. But the main reason for that is that wood fiber is a perfect material for noise reduction. So that was because it's a very dense material, it can really reduce the noise connectivity very, very. Another project, and I will show you a couple of non-residentials because in German it's called Passivhaus. If you translate that word by word, you end up with passive house. But that's not really correct, because it should be passive building, because we are not just talking about residential. It starts with residential, but I will show you a couple of other buildings. So that, for example, was the first passive house retrofit school in Austria. So you see still that old part of the school, so with an extension, a multi-purpose hall. And we have reached 14 kilowatt hour per square meter for that school. And there are some social studies which prove that kids who are sitting in that school about 6 hours a day, their learning success for sure is better. They have really good air quality. They have a nice, comfortable surrounding. So it's really a good environment for kids to learn. And it has a very beautiful side effect too. If you start to focus more on schools, you don't have to worry about our environment in 20, 30 years, because these kids really learn that the school is a better climate than probably most of them have in their own home when they come home. Another completely different project, an office building. That was my personal record in terms of airtightness, so 0.2 is really, really good value to reach. The only reason for that is it's a concrete structure, and with concrete it's easier to reach such airtightness values. We have calculated that building with 12 kilowatt hours per square meter, and then we have measured it the first 2 years. And the average of the 2 years was 8 kilowatt hours in reality. The reason for that was pretty simple. We have had a cooling system because we have calculated that we need a little bit of cooling, but at the end, we didn't need it, so it works properly without. So there is a cooling system inside which was never used. Especially in an office building, you have a lot of light, a lot of computers, a lot of different heat sources, monitors. So cooling is a big issue in an office building. Therefore, you also see that the window surface is not huge. It's quite sufficient to have enough natural light inside. But it's not just a glass facade, because with a glass facade you could never reach these values. Another project, 24 row houses, that was a very ambitious project, because at that time when they started, that was 2002, it was one of the bigger projects. So 24 row houses, mixed construction, very interesting thing, so wood and concrete combined, but also as a composite. So there was wood, concrete, composite inside too. And for sure, heat recovery again, and a small heat pump unit for every unit. The energy use of these buildings was between 9 and 13. That depends on the size. of the units because the units were different. And then we have made a thermographic picture just for checking purpose. So we made that picture to figure out if that's really properly working. And we have seen, okay, that's really dark blue, so that works really good. So just a very a few pictures from different residential houses. This is, I guess right now it's the biggest passive house assembly, so five relatively big buildings, office buildings, all passive house standard. Then one is, it's a production facility, so if the production process itself is not really energy intensive, you have all the same regulation requirements. You know, the 15 kilowatt per hour, for example, never change. Doesn't matter if you're talking about a school, a residential, an office building, or a production facility. That's the rule with the 15 is always the same. And as long as you have a kind of a production where the production process itself is not really energy intensive, you could reach passive house standard with a building like that one. That was also a retrofit, so old crappy hall and then renovated. Municipality buildings are getting more and more common. So in Austria, for example, you have also nine provinces, little tiny ones. And in eight of these nine provinces, now it's the law that when municipality builds something new, it has to be a passive house. The biggest challenge is when you're dealing with heritage building. There you really, very often, it's not possible anymore. But with a retrofit or renovation, usually when you're allowed to insulate at the outside, most of the times it's possible. The only thing which always will be an issue is the basement, because you cannot insulate the basement afterwards, you know. You would have to lift the building, and that will never happen, so. This, for example, is a residential renovation, so I'm not talking about architecture. I just show that picture to make clear it is possible also with renovations. And that project, for example, was the last one where I was involved in Austria, so that is the Faculty of Architecture of the University of Innsbruck, and they want to renovate that one to Passive House 2. Okay, so what you get at the end, it's more than just an energy-efficient house. What I'm trying to say is, it makes no sense to argue with payback periods just in terms of energy, because that what you get is a way higher quality. You get, for example, hygienic and fresh air. Air is very, very important. So I guess most people of you know, you have to drink about two liter water per day. So if you don't have water, how long could you survive? Maybe 2-3 days, something like that. You have to eat, I guess, about half a kilogram or something per day. How long could you survive without? Maybe 2-3 weeks. But you have to breathe about 20-25 kilogram per day. How long can you survive? 2-3 minutes. So air is by far the most important thing we have, and we really have to focus more on that. And that means that we have to make sure that the air inside a building, and we are spending about 90% of our lifetime inside buildings in our Western culture, so we have to make sure that that kind of air quality is really good. And for sure it has also something to do with noise, because if you open a window, you have all the noise from the outside inside, which is especially in little bit bigger cities or on roads with high traffic, that's an issue. Maybe not somewhere in the middle of nowhere, but it is an issue, noise. So with these systems, you can close the windows, you can close them. You're allowed to open them, but you don't have to. And for sure you have a way higher quality of living, a way higher comfortable level. So both in winter and summertime. So that makes sense also, and it's always hard to calculate, okay, how much money is that worth? Just very quick, something what I've mentioned before, just a little bit of view into the future, where it could go in future, is what we call massive wood or solid wood. It's a very good combination with the passive house approach, because wood has a lot of thermal mass inside. So this so-called specific heat capacity, that's the way how to describe the thermal mass. So you're describing energy in relation to mass, to weight. So steel is about 0.5, something like that. Concrete is about 0.9, so almost a double. And again, the double wood, 1.7. So simply, you can store more energy in a kilogram of wood than you could store in a kilogram of concrete. So wood has a higher thermal mass than concrete. Okay, I know it's a little bit unfair because now we are comparing kilogram to mass. Everybody knows we should compare with volume. So 1 liter of concrete is for sure heavier than 1 liter of wood. But still then, what I try to show here is that wood has a huge thermal mass. We can use it. With simple stud walls, okay, that's really light construction and we don't have some thermal mass inside. But there are a whole bunch of different systems existing, and the first ones I've seen now here. So with these, you can use beetle wood. I mean, wood is really, really, really cheap here. So you could use that wood, and wood is the one and only renewable building material we have. You can recycle concrete, you can recycle steel, but you can not renew concrete or renew steel. Wood is the only one, because it's growing. In Austria, I think it's about every 3 minutes, something like that, and you have to imagine Austria is really tiny, so every 3 minutes, there is enough wood growing to build the next single family house. Every 3 minutes. I guess here in Canada, it's less than a second, because you have so much wood and relatively just a few people in relation. So that would be here very likely under a second. We have seen, okay, for sure we know we have different continents, we have different societies, and we have different building cultures. And the reasons for that are a whole bunch of different reasons. And unfortunately, we also have very, very different building codes. From my point of view, we should more focus on building codes which are related to the climate zone and less to a political zone. But that's another issue. But something we have all in common, because the basics of physics are exactly the same everywhere on that planet. So, and that's what we really have to focus on, I guess. So not so much on leads, even not so much on, call it however you want, net zero, passive house, or whatever. I think it's very simple. We have to focus on what is happening with the house, the physics, what we try to achieve. We want to make it comfortable. We want to make it efficient. That's what we really should do. So, yes, I would like to welcome all of you to the second solar age, because I'm strongly convinced that the fossil age is about to end. And again, we should not wait until there is no fossil energy anymore. It's up to us to make the difference and to make that leap.
This speech by Dr. Guido Wimmers on May 24, 2008 was presented by the Lighthouse Sustainable Building Center. Find them at sustainablebuildingcenter.com, with the Canadian spelling of center being C-E-N-T-R-E. Contact Guido Wimmers at gwimmers@eqcanada.com. You can get an eyeful of the super energy-efficient buildings described in this talk at www.eqcanada.com. This speech and the Q&A from the workshop can be downloaded free from the Climate Solutions page at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith, and thank you so much for listening.
This is Bruce Springsteen, Radio Nowhere.